Guy Fieri finger blasts a holiday gnome or something like that, and within 12 minutes.
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Agnesen from CinemaSins, joined as always by the voice of CinemaSins, Jeremy Scott.
Hip hip hooray!
And from Music Video Sins, Barrett Scher.
Happy birthday!
Yeah, if you get out in the sun, you're going to melt.
It's no one's birthday. Happy birthday. Why does Frosty say that? I watched this the other night.
It's his birthday.
It's his birthday.
Well, why is he saying it to himself? Who says happy birthday to
himself?
He's got
the mind of a child. I did when I was 15. I was going to say 8, but I did it well into my teens. Happy birthday! It's my birthday!
Okay, that explains a lot.
That's why he says it, anyway. I mean, that's why he says it. Because he was, you know, he was a Pinocchio-like person who was just snow, and then somebody said some magic words, and he's living.
By the way, we watched the Christmas episode of The Goes Wrong Show last night.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's good.
That part where the snowman gets start pulling into the fucking gift generator or whatever, and he has to climb down to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
So great. I love that show. Now I demand more. It's just like Middleditch and Schwartz. There's so little that
it's
I need some more.
And you need more.
What are you guys angry about?
I feel like I'm taking crazy pills!
I'm as mad as hell!
You've never seen me very upset.
Oh, man. I gotta pull up my notes to remember.
Several, man.
Jeremy wrote like a bullet point list of how many things you're pissed off about.
Okay, so my biggest rant is just going to make me sound horny, which I guess is probably already part of my reputation.
I'm fine by that.
When 25% of your movie is fucking, make it rated R and show us some fucking.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I saw this movie called Equals. It's a sci-fi movie with it basically stars Kristen Stewart, Nicholas Holt, and Guy Pearce.
Mm-hmm.
So, hey, promising, right?
Right.
The premise is like they don't feel emotions. And emotions are a disease, and they have to take a cure so they don't feel emotions. I'll tell you what, it gave me vibes of Equilibrium and The Island and Divergent. And by that I mean it did not give me very many originality vibes.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow Nicholas Holt and Kristen Stewart both start to feel around each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I swear to God, the middle 30 minutes of this movie is them sneaking off to fuck every night. Mm-hmm. And the movie makes no doubt. The movie's not saying they're kissing and then they hug and say goodnight, or they're only holding. The movie is saying they are fucking. Mm-hmm. But it's PG-13. And so we get to see them kiss, and they slide down the wall, and it fades to another thing. And then they're both back at work or pretending to be automatons. And then 5 minutes later, they're sneaking off the back door to go kiss. And then they slide down the wall and it fades to something else. And I'm just like, if the point of the fucking movie is they're having a passionate, lurid, torrid love affair, I'm making up words.
Torrid.
Show us some of it. Right? Like, why would you make that a PG-13 film? The whole point of the movie is them discovering their sexuality and their bodies and having this lust. And I watched.
I mean, obviously, of course he did. Obviously, this has more to do with Kristen Stewart than it does with the actual movie.
I can defend this. This is not. She's naked.
No, I'm totally on board with what Jeremy's saying here. There's a lot of examples of this.
Yes.
What's another example? I was thinking about 1984 as being very similar to this, right? Because the protagonist and his mate, they go off and have this torrid affair.
But they also show nudity and everything in 1984. So.
Oh, really? It's been so long since I've seen it.
I don't know if they show them like really just banging one out or anything. But
that's what I remember about 1984.
That's right. Where the headboard is like you know, just bumping up against the wall and shit. There's a lot of nudity in it though. I know what he's saying. It happens with even when there's like there's not sex, but the character is playing like a stripper or something like that. Like the big all-time one that you think of in this is Sin City, mm-hmm. Where Jessica mm-hmm. Alba agrees to be a stripper in Sin City. Now, I agree. If you don't want to get naked, don't get naked. But also, it's so silly to watch a stripper, and Bruce Willis is pissed off that she's grown up to be a stripper when she's fully clothed.
She could go to high school in that outfit, man.
Exactly. Exactly. So it doesn't make any sense for the movie for him. Yeah. Yeah.
That's my point. And I have seen Kristen Stewart naked in plenty of films. If I needed that, I could go find that. That's not the point. The point is the movie is saying, it could be any cast. The movie is saying they are fucking. It's not like they're in love and there's daisies and it's happy. Like they're banging one out every night. And I just don't know why you make that movie. And it could very well have been the financiers or I don't know, studio. I don't know. I just don't. It felt like an R-rated movie that pulled all of its punches. Mm-hmm.
Well, what's wild about this is the R-rated movies that do this. I mean, again, like Sin City, obviously, but also the Favorite, where that's highly sexual, both with the Joe Alwyn character and with the Olivia Colman character. Mm-hmm. It's implied. And actually the Rachel Weisz and Olivia Colman characters. It's implied, but it's certainly, in fact, that's very implied. Like you could argue that 25% of that movie or more is about sex because that's a method by which you can become the favorite. That doesn't appear in that movie at all. So I get what you're saying. I got you. Yeah. I'm picking up what you're saying.
I hope people understand the nuance there and it doesn't just get boiled down into Jeremy's a horny turd fuckhole.
Yes.
I am that.
Right. No. It makes sense because the story you tell, this is what a lot of actors will refer to when they're talking about, well, I won't do nudity unless it's, important to the story or whatever. Well, a story about sex is, you know, that's the point. It doesn't get your point across by just showing them sliding off into a room somewhere and then cutting, you know, letting the wind blow through the curtains and shit like that.
Exactly. Like a train coming out of a tunnel.
Right. Yeah. You know, I mean, you know, go all the way. Don't, I mean, yeah, you know, that, if that's what that movie's about. So yes. I agree.
Thank you.
I'm glad you chose that one out of the bullet point list.
I am too, actually. I think that was the most fun. But the other ones could have gotten boring easily.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you pissed off about, Chris?
So this just recently came up. I think it's my nitpicking of this may be nothing. The reason why this happens may not be anything, may not be any real reason for it, but I find it highly irritating when I watch ESPN and they show the players, like they'll show the crawls at the bottom of all the news that's going on during the day. And they'll say, this player is out for the game due to virus. Mm-hmm. And they say virus. They don't say COVID. Mm-hmm. They say out because of virus. And whoever's doing those, whoever's in charge of those things, it happens on every single time somebody is mentioned, by the way. It doesn't matter if it's NASCAR, doesn't matter if it's whatever. Tests positive for virus is what they say. Now, the person who's writing this is doing probably the bare minimum of contempt for what COVID is, I think. So that nobody really, like, somebody like me comes out and says, what the fuck is up with that? Test positive for virus. You know, it sounds like a stupid argument, right? It is a stupid argument. But at the same time, I'm going to call out your bullshit, ESPN. Uh-huh. This fucking test positive for virus. If the person had AIDS, would you say test positive for virus?
Yeah, no, no.
You would not do that. You would say test positive for AIDS. You would spell out what they got. If they have the flu, you would say they have the flu. But for COVID, you're saying virus, very, very, very like broad term for something. And I think the person in charge of that is probably not taking this shit seriously.
Oh man, I'm even more conspiracy theorist than that.
I think there's money at the top.
I think there are so many people that are reading those scrolls without hearing the audio. I'm thinking about sports bars, but I'm also thinking about people at home like me. Like right now, I don't have my TV on ESPN, but my TV is muted and it's turned on. And if it was on ESPN, I might glance over and read the scroll, but not hear an anchor say COVID or what have you. I think I am just dumb enough to think there is a purpose, especially since you're saying it's across every sport. You're saving, if you just write COVID, you're not saving any letters at all. Nope. Virus and COVID are the same length. If you write COVID-19, you add two extra letters. Coronavirus is longer, I guess. But the argument that we're saving text is too thin here. So it has to be intentional. And I don't think one person controls the scrolls for 24 hours a day at ESPN. I think there are different people, which makes me think this is a rule taped to the fucking computer screen of the guy that types the office of the scroll typers that says, always call COVID virus, because I wouldn't be surprised if the NFL was like saying, please don't call it as often as you can, call it virus instead of COVID.
It's not even the NFL. What I've seen from what I saw on the crawl, it was test positive. Like Nick Saban test positive.
Not even virus anymore.
Yeah, they're not. This was before, so maybe they've somebody's told them to add virus, because that's more specific than test positive. But that would always drive me crazy. Like, you know, this guy test positive, this woman test positive. I'm like, I had the same level of annoyance as you did. I'm like, wait, you can't finish that sentence? It takes nothing to finish that sentence. It's not like you even have to have the text bars in justified format like we have on our sends videos. It crawls. You can write complete sentences and they crawl along.
I've begun to project on those every time I see test positive for virus. I've started to make it sound sarcastic in my mind. Test positive, like putting quotes around it. Test positive for virus. You know, that's how stupid it looks on screen when they say they test positive for a virus. You know, like for virus. Like I was sitting there thinking, if you are, and obviously, I mean, how many people in the world haven't heard of COVID at this point, right? There might actually be some people out there that haven't heard of it.
Yeah.
But like, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking about the guy who's in a coma for 3 years and he wakes up and an ESPN is up while he's, and it's like, test positive for virus. What does it mean?
It's Cillian Murphy in 28 Days Later. He's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
What are you guys talking about? What is this virus?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately what it comes down to is we're very specific about everything. When they get hurt, it's like, you know, Todd Gurley, knee, can't play.
Out with a knee.
Yeah. Carson Wentz, shoulder and groin and all these different places. They'll be very specific about that. It's not like Carson Wentz out. Injury.
Yeah.
That's exactly what that fucking virus thing is saying, basically, is it's something broad. It's something that you don't need to worry about, I guess.
It's like a hockey report, right? Like lower body injury.
Even hockey only does that in the playoffs, man. In the regular season, they'll be like spleen.
Xiphoid process.
Anyway, I find that irritating. I know that we do these rants. They're all, you know, they're usually based on something kind of small and irksome a lot of times. They're not always big things or whatever. And in this case, that's not a big thing to be worried about in the case of the world of the day. But I do think there is something going on there where they're doing the bare minimum and they're not taking it seriously. Or like Jeremy's saying, there's an edict that saying don't call it COVID on screen, and you know, like it's fucking Voldemort or something. So,
the virus that should not be named.
You let us know.
COVID-mort.
In the next couple of weeks, you let us know if it changes to like China virus or something. And then
See, Wuhan virus. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I would like to hear Mark from American Movie pronounce COVID.
COVID. Meme has circulated, by the way. It's called COVID.
COVID.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I've got an even more important rant than that.
Well, more important.
Cocky bastards.
It's frightening important. Almost. All right. There's a new channel. Yeah, I still have cable. We all still have cable. You know what, kids? Deal with it. Deal with it. Mm-hmm. We got cable. We flip channels. All right, bitches. All right. Mm-hmm. So there's a new channel on this cable that I have. I have not snipped the cord, and it's called Recipe.TV. It's right in the bunch of the cooking channels. There's the literal cooking channel, and then there's Food Network, and then there's Recipe.TV. Mm-hmm. And what Recipe.TV does between insufferable commercials, because it's a nascent network and it's trying to get all the revenue that it can, so they're doing dermabrasion shit and stuff like that. But when they do air stuff, it's people making recipes for food that you can consume. Mm-hmm. And some of it is redundant. There's this Irish woman that's very, very pleasant, but she makes Irish food, and I have no interest in Irish food. All right. Soda bread can suck my dick. All right. It's not tasty. Jesus. Guinness is right. I don't really care about cooking with it. They do have, I'm kidding, Irish people. I love you. But they do have like a chef that does Parisian bistro cooking. And they have like, you know, chefs from all over LA that show you how they make their fine dining things from scratch, from everything that they do, every step. This is what I crave. There's a reason that Julia Child was so popular back in the day. There was a reason that Jacques, the Cajun guy, Jacques Cousteau.
Emeril Lagasse?
There was a Cajun cook called Jacques something. Emeril Lagasse, Rachel Ray, even that they became so popular is that they took an empty pan, an empty cutting board, no mise en place, and they started making a meal. And then you could see the meal to its completion, and you could make that meal. What you have on Cooking Network and Food Network now is like Guy Fieri finger blasts a holiday gnome or something like that, and within 12 minutes. And it's a competition of finger blasting.
I don't finger blast your hat off, you stupid gnome.
And it's always competitions. It's always time limits. It's always like we're gonna show. Or I even do like the Guy Fieri goes in the kitchen and watches people make stuff. The diners and the drives and the dine-ins, because it actually shows. Even though it's quick, it shows how to make these recipes. It goes too quickly and it's too kitschy, but at least you can see how these recipes are done. And I've used some of those, but there is nary an episode on these channels where you can see, hey, here's what I've got. I've got my grill going. I've got my griddle going. I've got this going. I've got my water boiling. And here's how I make something. Much like Binging with Babish does. He takes it from the very beginning up until the very end. Shows you all the screw-ups in between and that kind of thing. But when you're watching on television, why don't we have more cooking shows? Those are popular. Those are popular. We don't need Michael Simon buttfucks Bobby Flay over a barbecue for $70 million for charity while he's grilling a steak. I don't need to see that. Even the steak part, I don't need to see that. I just need to see how to make food and food that I might not normally make. Don't you think that would be a popular thing? If you're interested, I'm very interested in food programming. So this appeals to me.
I have a theory about this. All right. Mm-hmm. I have a theory about this. Those shows are popular. But not because people actually want to cook that shit.
Which shows are popular?
The shows where somebody, I'm not talking about Recipe TV, which I did flip to, by the way. I'm talking about like the, okay, my wife watches a slew of Sunday cooking shows on the Food Network. These are not competition shows. These are like the Girl Meets Farm and the
Pioneer
Woman. Oh, yeah.
Freaks me out, dude.
Okay, well, point is, she basically shows you how to make from start to finish. There are more cuts in between, but my wife loves those shows. We have cookbooks from both of those women, and we've never made one of those dishes. And we cook a lot. So I don't know that Recipe TV will be as popular as people who aren't like you, because I think you are unique, and part of the reason why Food Network, other than Sundays, has pushed largely into this stupid ass competition, tiny spatulas, world's worst cooks, like it's really mindless, dumb, stupid, like, you know, Guy Fieri finger blasts a pork belly sandwich, or pork belly sandwich. I mean, the other half of their the other half of their program is literally watch people eat. Watch people take bites of awesome food and go, mmm.
Yeah.
That's like half their shows.
Well, and that's so, what Chef's Table is on Netflix too. And that's what Ugly Delicious is on that and stuff like that. It's all of this food programming
saying,
has moved into what
you're
saying.
That's what people are watching. That's what people, I don't think Recipe TV is going to do well with only recipe programming, because I think there's only so much of that, and that's almost always personality driven, not recipe driven.
So you think the market is not, if Julia Child were to come out today, you don't think that she would find the audience that she found?
I do, because she was a personality. But I don't know that a network entirely devoted to start to finish recipe episodes can sustain. I don't think there's a reason that the Food Network isn't doing it anymore.
I can't
claim to know what it is, but
people love the holiday bake-off where you fucking
that
have
shit
a gingerbread.
Or let's make a cake the size of a children's bed and make it all out of frosting. Like, I could give a rat's ass.
Lay
like,
down in it, Timmy, and then you can eat your way out.
Oh, man.
Anyway, it pisses me off. I want to learn how to cook stuff, especially if it's somebody like there was an Indian lady that would do Indian dishes from scratch. And you could see how that worked. There was a Mexican lady on Food Network that would show you how to make Mexican dishes from scratch. I need to know this so I'm not making, you know, honey soy salmon for the next 30 years like I've been doing, like I did last night. It was delicious, by the way.
Okay. Well, I also want to point out that Recipe TV is showing like several hours in a row of Catherine's Farmhouse Kitchen. So I think they may have like a content problem as well.
They do. They're trying
Catherine
to get
is not
more
very engaging
there.
To me.
No.
God love her. And and yet she's on this channel for the next 3 hours. So
that Parisian dude is fucking awesome, though. He's going to become the – if this does take off, he's going to become the star. He'll
jump to Food Network and make more money.
Probably.
A tiny spatula competition.
He's going to be on Beat Bobby fucking Flay.
Here's tonight's competition. You have to make a giant pancake with a spatula the size of your toe.
You have to stir the ingredients only with your genitalia. And it's weird because I like it when they do that on Top Chef, but I think Top Chef is the exception to the rule.
They
completely.
Definitely are, because 99% of their competitions are about cooking, and when they do that stuff, it's more for fun and almost always in that quickfire competition, not in the final elimination competition. Anyway, good rant.
All right, you ready to do some recommends and warns?
Yeah!
Totes amazeballs.
They're great.
It won the Academy Award.
Oh, for what?
For best movie ever made.
Fuck yeah. I got a little long list of them shits, too.
Bring it.
Fuck yeah.
All right. Well, I saw Happiest Season with my wife.
Okay. Another case due.
Another case due. Yes, this was not intentional. I was curious about this movie. The trailer was good. And listen. One thing I will tell you about this movie is there's someone in this cast you want to sleep with.
Oh,
I'm just telling you outright, because it's Kristen Stewart, it's Mackenzie Davis, it's Dan Levy. It's the guy from the TV show Limitless, who's quite hunky. It's Aubrey Plaza. Ah, it's Alison Brie.
Alison Brie's in this?
Yes, it's stacked with beautiful people.
Wow.
Can I sleep
with all of them?
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
I was in the tank for this movie for various reasons, including my crushes, before it arrived. And I'll be honest, it's possible that has colored my interpretation, although my wife had the same reaction I did. And I know at least one Sins team member liked this movie, so I feel bad, but this movie's not funny, man.
Is it supposed to be?
It's trying to be.
Yeah.
And it's not a Christmas movie. Like, I'm not here to debate what is and isn't a Christmas movie, but it's called Happiest Season, and it's coming out at the end of November. The only Christmas is the fact that it's Christmas time. They're going home to one girl's parents' house to celebrate Christmas. So there's a tree, and there's a Christmas party. Every single bit of this movie could have taken place in June, and it wouldn't have impacted the story one bit. Nothing about this movie is about the Christmas spirit or any of that shit. The biggest problem is the two leads, who I adore, don't have chemistry.
Oh, that's wild.
And so I don't know if it's, you know, Kristen Stewart, she's a great actress, but I'm not sure traditional Christmas rom-coms, straight or gay, are her bag, man, because she still has that kind of how do you put your finger on it?
Aloofness?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And then she's great at aloofness.
Yeah.
It plays great in Charlie's Angels, but it doesn't play quite as well here. And so I was completely underwhelmed. I don't think it's bad, and I think this movie needs to exist for plenty of reasons. I think it's great that we have a Christmas romance movie with two lesbians that is pretty straightforward for Christmas rom-coms in terms of, I know there are plenty of people in the LGBTQ community that wish the movie had been other things, because it is ultimately a story about one person's coming out, and that is something they've seen a lot in movies. And I can only speak from my own experience, but I Dan Levy was hysterical. And the best part of the movie was every time he was on screen. Sadly, his character is very shoehorned into this movie and doesn't really need to be here, but he gives a great speech at the end that's very emotional. He's the best thing about the movie. If the rest of the movie had been up to his level in humor or commitment, I think it would have been a home run. I'm glad the movie exists, and I hope that you guys who watch it enjoy it more than I did, but it was kind of a letdown for me. So that's a Rekha Warren, mostly on the Warren side, but it's pretty and it has Christmas music in it. That may be your bag.
This is Mackenzie Davis hasn't come out to her family, right? And they go over.
That's correct. They're going home for Christmas, and on the way home, she informs Kristen Stewart that she has not come out to her parents yet. And there are several more layers of surprises along those lines. It's very standard. It's very standard beats. So you're not going to be surprised by almost anything in this movie. The dad is running for mayor, and that's part of why they're trying to keep the secret from coming out and not spoiling his chances. It reminded me of Black Sheep in that regard. trying to keep these antics away so that the relative can win a conservative office or what have you. And then by the end, maybe it's because it's a Christmas movie, but everything is tidy as fuck by the end of this movie. Like, people who were definitely homophobic hours later are completely redeemed because they accept everything now. Yeah, it's very, I don't know. I respect its intentions and I'm glad it exists, but it's not for me. I'm sorry.
To briefly touch on that Christmas movie argument, I know that we didn't want to get into that, but like, mm-hmm. a lot of the I think the issue comes from when you were growing up and you heard that a movie was coming out and it was a Christmas movie. It had Christmas themes. It had something about, you know, people opening presents, or there was some sort of Christmas miracle. It's, you know, these type of things that are happening in the movie. So whenever you said Christmas movie, it was shorthand for movies like that. Santa Claus, Miracle on 34th Street, It's a Wonderful Life, all these movies. So it's become a modern day phenomenon to see that if there is Christmas in the movie, to say, haha, look at what I discovered, guys. This movie is Christmas movie too, because it's also got Christmas in it, and it was set in Christmas and everything. And it completely detracts from what that original meaning of what a Christmas movie was. Now, I'm sure that now that we're entering this phase of life and everything, the Christmas movie is going to be redefined for a lot of people. And in Enemy of the State is a Christmas movie. And, you know, I don't hear a lot of people.
Iron Man 3,
exactly.
Any Shane Black.
Yeah, script. I was about to say anything Shane Black is a Christmas movie almost. I mean, that's where it comes from. Is like, I think that people who are like, haha, look at this, how clever this is, are forgetting that the original sort of connotations of that was, you say Christmas movie, and I conjure up images of Christmas being the main theme of the movie.
Yes, the magic, the spirit of giving, and Santa. Elf has like Christmas spirit magic at the end, and I'm not here for it. I guess it's just a fun game for me. It's exactly the same as is a hot dog a sandwich. It's just wasting our time. We are just spinning our wheels for no reason.
Yeah, it's another thing to sort of create discussion and isn't that fun? Isn't this fun talking about this? How Die Hard's a Christmas movie? Not really.
You know. Not for me.
But not you fun know. At all. Guess you got a bunch of people's juices flowing about it, whether they say yes or no about it. But
that's right.
All right, everybody, it is time to talk about Mubi once again.
Mubi!
There's all sorts of cool shit on there again. And I know that both Barrett and I saw the 11-minute short from Lorgos, Yorgos Lanthimos. I was about to do the Tatum Channing with there.
see, it can't be accidental.
That's right. There's an 11-minute movie from Yorgos Lanthimos on there called Nimic on there, and it's your typical weird Lanthimos type of thing. It's really cool.
Yeah, what'd you think? You dug it?
I dug it because it's that 11-minute, like, we don't have to explain anything kind of weirdness. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't have to make sense. It just has to mess with your mind. And it stars Matt Dillon as this guy who's like a family man, and he's waking up and he's doing all the normal family stuff, making breakfast and everything. And he goes to work and all that. And then he gets on the subway. And he asked this woman the time. He's like, "Do you have the time?" And she does. She just stares at him. And then like 5 seconds later, she goes, "Do you have the time?" And we don't know if Matt Dillon is really weirded out about it, actually, because he's just kind of like just stares at her. And then she starts following him. And it's crazy, man. Like, what is she following him about? And then it really gets weird after that.
It does. It does. And it actually reminds me a lot of Dogtooth, his first big feature. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that's not explained, but there's a lot of Matt Dillon rarely, I think, there's a few times where he gets to stretch his legs, his range with acting. Mm-hmm. And I think he does here. He's a cellist in an orchestra. Well, actually in an ensemble. And it's interesting because it's hard to mimic the vibrato of a stringed instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he plays the cello, if you've seen enough classical music, there's a way that they create that vibrato, that kind of shakiness on cello and violin and viola and stuff like that, that he does very, very well. Mm-hmm. It's very different from guitar, very different from, you know, even banjo, mandolin, that kind of thing. And the music is spectacular in mm-hmm, this, mm-hmm. but the story itself is insular and fascinating. I found this really, really fun. But again, he is my kind of happy spot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's tell people who, and by people, I mean, Jeremy, let's remind them what this guy has directed. It's Lobster Guy, right?
Yeah. The Lobster.
Yes, Lobster Guy.
Killing of a Sacred Deer. The Favorite is your
The Favorite is the one that I've seen mm-hmm. and did not like that much. Mm-hmm. I'm sure this is better.
He's got a very unique style, very deadpan. Lobster in particular is very deadpan.
I really need to watch that one. That one, I think, from everything I've heard, I think I would dig that one.
Oh, it's so mm-hmm. much fun. It is so much fun just to dig into that and what it means and all that
stuff.
But
I'm liking this 11-minute idea of going to the weird place because I could do that.
Yeah.
It was a movie exclusive, too.
Oh, that's awesome.
And yeah. It's one of those things where that's one of the cool things about movie is like, you know, the selection of the day a lot of times will be one of these 11 to 20-minute short films. And, you know, you get that out of the way in the day and everything. And they're usually pretty good, usually interesting. And this one certainly is. And you have that kind of director behind it and everything. You know, you mentioned the library as well. I went to the library because I had missed on its month long run, The Hills Have Eyes, the original Wes Craven. Original Wes Craven horror movie. I'd never seen it before, and I just really dig on these old 70s horror movies. There's something mm-hmm. about it. There's something where it seems like they're kind of like, they're not polished films at all.
Yeah.
There's something to that I've always been attracted to with those horror films and everything. And, this is one of those. I mean, yeah, it's got the bad acting and it's got, you know, all sorts of like, you know, like, oh my God, that's terrible. But at the same time, it's scary, especially in this one. And I can't remember the remake, how that one went down. I just remember I didn't like it too much.
No. Remake, no.
The messed up rednecks that are in the hills in this movie, they're smarter than the ones that we see in most of these type of horror movies. They're like actually dangerously smart in this movie. They can speak with, you know, with all sorts of like bigger words and like a great vocabulary and everything like that, but they're just monsters. And that's what makes them scary to me. They're not just, you know, we're killing because we're monsters, but they're just this way. It's just, I don't know. There's something about that. Even though they look different and they have this way about them, they're very smart. And that's what's scary about that movie.
Yeah. Those old school things. I agree with you. There's something more unnerving. Original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It just makes it a little more, I don't know, maybe realistic, quote unquote, to where it feels more tangible.
Mm-hmm.
Let me, guys, just real quick, let me tell you about, you mentioned the movie of the day. MUBI goes through and has 30 movies on its front-facing page. A new one comes out every day. And today's, as we record this on December 2nd, is called Faith.
Mm-hmm.
It's an Italian film about a kung fu master that recruits a bunch of people to join his religious sect. They are both self-identified as Shaolin monks and Catholic followers. So it's a weird disparity. It's filmed beautifully. The performances are great. You could argue whether or not this is a cult. In definition only, probably would be considered of it. They have a head of the sect called the Master, and he is very, very interested. He founded this sect to fight demons with martial arts, and so they train, and then at night they do religious prayer time and stuff like that. and the filming is beautiful. It's all in black and white. This was a journey for me, and I want to take you through my journey. The director is Valentina Pedinici, who's an up and comer, really, in Italy and starting in the film circuit. It shows it's males and females. It shows them intimate. It shows them, you know, getting ready for training. It shows the abuse, the emotional abuse that this guy, the master, inflicts upon them, presumably to get them to train harder, because they're out there. They really think they're called the Warriors of Light. And they think that they're preparing for battle. He's in a closed off castle, right? So here's my journey for it. Watch the movie. Movie's spectacular.
Mm.
Performances are great.
Mm.
Then I find out, didn't know anything about this. Then I find out it's a documentary. This woman assimilated herself into this sect to where they gave her carte blanche and was filming all of this. She had talked to somebody who had excommunicated themselves about 4 years earlier, but she spent 3 months in here getting this footage. It's a docu-fucking-mentary, and that will blow your mind. I wish I didn't even tell you that before you watch that, because it looks so much like it's all very much like The Vow or the other Nexium documentary, where they get so much footage that you're like, this has to be staged, right? But this is spectacular. The last thing about this is that I really wanted to see what Pedinici did for the rest of her career. Pedicini, I should say. She died at 42 about a week and a half ago.
Really?
Yes, from liver cancer. So this has been like a whole journey. The film is spectacular. Did not know it was a documentary. And the fact that she unfortunately passed away was just like this whole emotional roller coaster for me.
Yeah.
That came from... The film itself is an emotional roller coaster. I swear to God, you guys will get absorbed in this. But the circumstances behind it is even more compelling. So I would recommend this, full-throated recommend, both the Yorgos Lanthimos short that we saw earlier and this film Faith by Valentina Pedicini. Absolutely. Go to Mubi. .com/CinemaSins, MUBI.com/CinemaSins. I'm telling you, you will have your mind blown at least a few times, like I did with this experience. I had my mind blown from that short, but I was kind of expecting to have my mind blown. And the Faith documentary is going to absolutely blow your mind. Mubi.com/CinemaSins. You get for this, you go to that URL, you get 30 days free to explore your cinematic proclivities. And that's going to be 30 days free. You can watch a ton of movies on Mubi. Go to Mubi.com/CinemaSins and you can thank us later. You can give us big air hugs over the internets and we will accept them.
I was watching Apple TV, and I'd seen some trailers for Ted Lasso, and the trailers did not make me want to go watch it at all. I thought it looked like it was just trying to be a dumb comedy, you know, a lot of pratfalls, a lot of little things like that in it, and so I wasn't interested. But then suddenly I started seeing people on Twitter like going, hey, this show is great, and this show, and it started to build up some steam, and I was like, okay, maybe I'll give it a shot then. Jason Sudeikis plays Ted Lasso, who is a coach. He's a football. He's like a Division II college football coach who has been asked by this, Premier League English soccer football league to coach their team. And their team is like, I guess, like a middling team. They're in danger of relegation and all that type of thing. But they're, you know, they've got like, they've got an aging star on the team that's not nearly as good as he once was. They have one guy who is on loan from another team who's awesome, but he's an asshole. And then a variety of other, like, you know, these guys are pretty good, whatever. But he comes in and he's hired because the owner of the team is a new owner. It's the former wife of a guy who was like a well known in the UK for being a philanderer and everything. And they've just gotten a big divorce and she got the team out of it. And she wants to kind of like in Major League, she wants to ruin this team because this is her husband's baby essentially. And her husband, by the way, is played by Anthony Head, the guy from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Interesting. Oh, yeah. I like that guy.
Yeah. And she, I can't remember her name right now. She was maybe best known to a lot of people as the woman who kept saying shame behind Lena Headey in Game of Thrones.
Wow.
She did a lot of that, you know, fucked up stuff in Game of Thrones, torturing Lena Headey throughout that whole run there. But she hires him and he has no idea, of course, about anything soccer at all. He comes in with this positive attitude and this, you know, this whole like, you know, let's go get him and everything. And he's got an assistant. His assistant is hilarious. The assistant seems to know even more than he does about everything. He's like really researched a lot of stuff. But they know that there's not much chance of success. They don't measure success by wins and losses and all that stuff and whatever. And that sounds really hokey, but, This series is so weirdly positive in a great way where it's not to the point where you're like, oh my God, that's just too nice. That's just too sickeningly nice, you know, and things like that. Jason Sudeikis plays Ted Lasso with this positive, upbeat attitude, and he's always positive, but yeah, you can still see some little bits of like sadness and maybe some anger and whatever popping up as people keep on telling him that, and, you know, like, of course he's a coach that's not going to win very many games. So as soon as he goes out there and loses his first game, everybody's calling him a wanker and everybody's calling him a wanker. Like everybody's, you know, like just keeps on calling him that all the way through. He goes to the bar and people are like, "Hey, wanker." And it becomes his name almost, so he's looking for these little positives that, you know, throughout this, he knows it's a long shot, but he also is trying to make everything good. Every episode is just, I don't know. It's just charming as hell, man. I would highly recommend this show if you've got Apple TV and it's just sort of find out for yourself what I mean. It's very funny. Very funny. Well-written. Sudeikis is so good in this that I was watching Horrible Bosses and I was like, forgot that it was the same guy.
Oh, wow. Huh. Wow.
That's how good he is in Ted Lasso. I mean, it's, you know, it's obvious it's Jason Sudeikis, right? Like, it's not like, you know, he's not a completely different person or anything, but when you watch him in Horrible Bosses, you're like, that's the same guy that's playing Ted Lasso.
No, like, he doesn't make any sense. He's got his thing. He's the smarmy asshole. Mm-hmm. And yeah, even if he's the protagonist, like in one of my guilty pleasures is the We're the Millers and Jennifer Aniston, where do you guys like that movie? It's kind of fun, right?
It's fun.
But he's always playing some sort of smarmy asshole, and you love him, you love to hate him, but you know, he's just funny like that. But yeah, this sounds, I haven't heard one negative thing about this show, and it's a 180 for his type, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm. It totally is. There's not one moment where he gets into that whole thing that we know him for and all the other movies and everything. Maybe hints of it here and there, but nothing to the point that it overtakes the character. You know, he's got his own thing too. Also in the show, he's left his wife and his kid to come out here to do this, but we find out that they're kind of on the rocks and they don't know if they're going to be able to get back together and everything like that. And you know, he has to do the mature thing, but he also has to, I think he wants to be this always positive person. So whenever it shows him that he's in a worse state, you're like, oh no, you know, like this could really be a big moment. But But yeah, Ted Lasso, really, really, really good. And I would say if you have Apple TV, go for it. It's I think it's 10 episodes right now.
Nice. All right. Very good. Well, thanks, man. I have to pull the trigger on that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get back to Christmas.
Oh, let's do it.
Season. Mm-hmm. And this is a movie that we've talked about before, but I don't think we've gone into any depth into it. And it's the first time I have seen this movie all the way through. Office Christmas Party.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I've seen talk about chunks of this many, many times. And I came away from this movie thinking, this is the most watchable movie I've ever seen that's not really funny. I very rarely laughed at this, but I was amused all the way through. It's right. A very bizarre concept because it's fun and it's not good, but it's fine, but it's not hilarious as it should be, especially with this cast. This cast is ridiculous. It is one of those rare movies that the setup is less funny by far than the end of the movie. The end of the movie is much better, I think, than the beginning of the movie.
Except that's when she uses electricity outlets to reroute the internet.
This is the perfect storm. All the internet is out.
But techno nerd Olivia Munn.
Yeah. But besides that, like the whole time when they take TJ Miller back to Jillian Bell's brothel. And they get into the whole like, oh man, it sucks being the boss. And then they get into the car chase and the whore is back in the back seat. And she's like, you can't shoot him. He's going to crash the car. And then they fucking try to jump. That was the part that I was laughing so much on. Of course, it's very Chicago. I cannot help but believe that this was not based on a real thing of which my cousin has participated in. One of the most epic Christmas parties in all of Chicago at an ad agency downtown, right in the same area that they were in. But I kind of love it, but I also just think that it's a wasted opportunity. Jennifer Aniston plays one note. Kate McKinnon is the star of the show. Jillian Bell maybe is up there.
This cast is amazing. You haven't mentioned like Rob Corddry and Randall Park and
Randall Park is fucking
Randall funny. Park. Okay, so I don't. Jason
Bateman has been mentioned.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
I agree with you. I don't think it has very many laughs, but it is very amusing.
Yes,
it's crazy to me how many of the jokes are so base, like. Yeah. He's sucking an ice cock while he's drinking that shot of liquid. Or
I got a picture of you deep throating that.
They're dancing in fat suits. Or you know, it's just so one note, but there's something about it that I've probably seen it seven or eight times in parts. it's very amusing. I love that Randall Park scene when they go into the nursery and he keeps doing this kind of baby cosplay thing.
And Vanessa Bayer actually is a really good addition to this.
She is. And she's like, she's okay for a second. She's like, no, seriously, it's just a thing. He's like, no, okay, I'll stop. And then he says something like, can you check my diaper?
Yeah,
she's like,
okay, there's something going on in my diaper.
Save that shit for the fourth date like a normal person.
Yeah.
So, yes, there are laughs in there. But like, oh, my God. Yeah, you're right. They're very basic jokes, except for when Kate McKinnon can really, I think I have to imagine that some of this is improv. Like when she pulls up in the van and she's like, it's a Kia. That's what God would drive.
and TJ Miller has that great line reading too, where he's like, shut the fuck door.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. TJ Miller. I do like, well, I tell you what, this movie does have some sentimentality to it. It's almost like to do another Chris Farley comparison. It's almost like Tommy Boy, right? Where he's like he's trying to keep all the staff together. Jennifer Aniston is his sister, and she wants to fire everybody because she's all about the bottom line. But he's like, you know, here's how we do it. And then I would be remiss. Courtney B. Vance, after he gets blown up by cocaine, is fantastic in this.
Yo, he's hilarious.
Yeah, especially after all this goes down. It's insanely watchable. I'm going to keep watching it like probably 7 or 8 times.
I want to like T.J. Miller just because of some of his public incidents, but he's very funny in this movie. Early on, when they go into the bathroom and he and Jason Bateman are talking, he's at the urinal and somebody has doodled Jennifer Aniston fucking him. And that's his sister. And he goes, incest and rape? That's dark. And then he just goes about peeing. Like, it's no big deal.
And then he's got the great follow-up when they're going into the store where he's like, oh, I'll show them. They've got a picture of her fucking me. I'm going to fuck her. Maybe this movie is funnier than I gave it credit for.
Bateman has a lot of good, like, one-liners in this movie. Like, because T.J. Miller spouts out some statistic in a meeting, and he's like, not sure where you came up with that number, but just very Jason Bateman. We've talked way too much about this movie, but I do love it.
I get the sense that Jason Bateman is underrated and will perpetually be underrated because he's never going to be one of those comic stars that we know that just go completely bananas and everything. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not going to be a Will Ferrell or a Jim Carrey or anybody like that. But I was talking about, you know, watching Horrible Bosses. There's a couple of line readings in that just I love. There's nobody else that could do it like Jason Bateman. There's the one where they say that, you know, they've gone to the station and Wendell Pierce is like you were speeding 60 miles an hour through a 25 mile an hour zone, and he's like, I was drag racing. I'm a drag racer. And Ron White's like, you were doing it in a Prius. And there's this pause and he looks up and he's like, I don't win a lot. And like, I feel like there's so many actors who would say that line in a different way where they would be a little bit too protesty about it. You know, they would be like, I don't win a lot. You know, that would be the line reading most comic actors would do. But I don't win a lot.
Yeah.
It's just hilarious to me. All right, everybody, it's time to talk about BetterHelp.
BetterHelp. Hey, I just had a therapy session.
Nice.
I've been on back on my weekly jam with my therapist, and I tell you what, I feel like I've gotten my head right to the point where I'm looking more inward and outward. I don't want to take you all on my journey. It doesn't have really anything to do. But what we're working on right now is balance. There's different domains, Jeremy. I don't know if you've touched on this, but there's a certain balance or imbalance that I've never even thought about. And this is maybe my favorite part of this counseling service from BetterHelp, is that you get the right counselor/therapist, and they're going to bring up things that you didn't even think about. Things that sometimes you think are second nature. They're like, oh yeah, I know that. I've got that handled, that kind of thing. And then they'll say, well, one of the simple questions, like, who are you? I'm like, oh, really? You're gonna pull that? And like, who are you? What are your core values? That kind of thing. And you're like, I've already taken care of that. I'm an old man at this point. I'm an old man. Mm-hmm. You know, I steal things. I don't remember what I put in my pockets at Brentano's. Mm-hmm. But you know, the fundamental questions that we kind of gloss over are very important to reexamine, no matter what age you are, no matter what time you are in your life. And you have to look at your balance of physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, familial, that kind of thing, and take stock of it. And without counseling specifically for me from BetterHelp, I would not have thought about that. I would have just compartmentalized that stuff and just said, what am I doing today? I'm writing this. I'm reviewing this. I'm doing that. I'm making dinner. I'm going to bed, that kind of thing. If you dig deeper, you're going to find more satisfaction as the therapeutic process goes forward. And Jeremy, have you experienced that kind of thing?
Yes. Not probably in the same terminology. I'm guessing it's a lot like NFL play calling systems.
Sunday.
The core is the same, but everybody uses different terminology. Yeah. You know, what I would just say to those of you, this is, you know, we've said this so many times, you know, it's a pandemic, it's a scary time, people are losing their jobs, people are being evicted, people are getting sick, it's a very anxious time, and it's hopefully making you more interested in therapy than ever before, but I implore you not to waste your own time with therapy, but by that I mean, be honest. I know a lot of people, myself included, who have wasted months in therapy just not telling the therapist the truth because I wasn't really ready to deal with it.
Oh, my God. That's the worst, where it's like, I really want to get into this, but then I really got to get real.
Yeah. And I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just saying you do more work in therapy and you grow more as a person the more honest you are with yourself and with your therapist. It's the same as with a doctor. You know, if you think you have a heart problem, but you're scared to find out you do, so you go to the doctor and complain about a elbow pain, you're not going to, you know what I mean? That's not going to help you. And so, you know, do yourself a favor. Don't waste your therapist's time, obviously, but, you know, at the same time, you are paying for this service. So make good use of it by being honest. This is the time, and you can make huge leaps and how to deal and cope with that anxiety and that depression that's choking you out.
That's a great point. It's like the Dr. House thing. Everybody lies, right?
Yeah.
even in life-threatening situations, which, you know, they certainly happen all the time.
Yeah.
To get to the heart of the diagnosis, he has to assume that everybody lies. And as a former therapist, I kind of had that mentality too. Like, until you break through that, or until the patient is ready to break through.
That's true.
You're just going to kind of treat what we can see right now, and then we start digging down. And I think that's where I'm at right now.
Yeah.
BetterHelp, listen, Jeremy mentioned the pandemic and our current situation and everything. Things are looking a little bit brighter, which I'm very much looking forward to with vaccinations and things like that. But at this point, BetterHelp is really a great service. You can do it from the comfort of your own home, on your computer, on your tablet, on your phone. There's a chat option. There's a video option. You can communicate on your counseling room. You get set up with a matched counselor. They've got so many people signing up that they're recruiting more licensed counselors. If you go to betterhelp.com, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/sincast, you get 10% off your first month, and that is certainly not nothing. You can use that to really start off your whole journey. And if you have problems with payment, let them know. They've got services for them. The fact that you can schedule things, the fact that you can communicate easily, the fact that you can see your counselor really as much as you need to, and you get matched with somebody who matches your needs – This service is spectacular. You've heard us talk about it before, but we're going to keep on talking about it, because if you've waited this long to say, like, maybe I should do this, do it now. BetterHelp.com/Sincast. Go ahead with your bad self.
Oh, is it my turn again?
It is.
All right. So I'm going to go with a documentary I saw on HBO called Transhood.
Okay.
And this is a documentary that follows four trans individuals from a young age. I believe one is 5, one is 8 or 9, one is 13, and one is 15.
Hmm.
The conceit of the documentary is that it follows these individuals for 5 years. so you get to see them grow and change as individuals through a 5-year journey. and so the oldest one, I'm going to forget the names and mess it up, and I'm sure I'm going to mess up the pronouns. But the oldest transitioning to a female and is looking into confirmation surgery by the end of the documentary and wants to be a model. And her story is very fascinating. She has a super dad who just is 100% behind her. The next youngest is transitioning to male, and he has a super mom who is super supportive and loving. Does seem to push him a little bit to come out just because she seems afraid that he'll be hurt by friends in the future if they find out. Like, by the end of the documentary, he's looking at college, and she's saying, you should maybe tell your roommates. the next youngest one before that is transitioning to female and becomes somewhat of a celebrity, even though she's like 9 years old. She ends up on the cover of National Geographic, going to conventions, writes a book. Wow. And what's interesting about her journey is by the end, she's done. She wants none of it. And she's already famous in the trans community. Like, even the day the National Geographic photographer shows up to take her picture for the cover, she doesn't want to do it. And she even tells the camera by the end, it's heartbreaking, but she says, I don't want to be known for being trans. I want to be known for being me. I want to be known for being fun. The next youngest below her is transitioning to female, but by the end of the documentary has changed his mind and decided he's a boy. And the parents have divorced because the dad wanted to keep supporting the trans stuff, and the mom, by the end of the documentary, says it's a mental illness. And that's when something I hate in documentaries happens, and the director speaks off camera and inserts herself into the film to say, that's a pretty big change from how you felt 5 years ago, which I don't really even feel was necessary to lead her to that. The audience can get that. so ultimately, here's what I'm going to say. It's a wreck of Warren, because I think it's a topic that we all need to learn more about. And that was what I was drawn to in watching it. But there's not a lot of new ground covered here. Terms of, you know, a lot of doctor's visits about gender confirmation surgery with concerned parents. And I've seen that in a few documentaries and shows, which is not to say it's not, you know, we need more representation for this kind of thing. But it's just not a very well-made documentary. I think it's an interesting topic, and I think the subjects it chose were interesting. And I especially think it's interesting to note like how young a couple of these people decided, I'm not my birth gender. I'm the opposite gender. And I don't have kids. I don't know what I would do in that situation, especially if they were 5 years old. I think that's the most complicated one, is that the dad was like, I'm just trying to love my kid and do whatever they need. And, you know, if it's, you know, to be trans or to not be trans anymore, I want to be whatever they need me to be. But it still seems like such a hard journey, because they had two other kids who were not trans, who were at times feeling neglected. Fascinating topic. Ultimately not a very well-made documentary in my view. So it's a wreck of Warren. If it interests you from what I've said, I think you'll get something out of it.
Yeah. I want to check this out, even if it's not really well-made, because that is a fascinating thing. Plus, I'm very interested in this longitudinal type of documentary. Did you guys ever see the 7-Up series, the 7-Up, 14-Up, 21-Up?
I saw a couple of them a long time ago.
I've never seen them. I've always wanted to, but I have never seen them.
Fascinating. By the time I watched it back in probably 1995, it was 35 up.
And so I watched all the way to 63, I think.
Yeah. Which is amazing. But the 7-Up and the 14-Up, I forget, it's a French director that did it.
Well, originally, I believe Michael Apted was on these. It might be somebody new now. I'm not sure.
You're right. Michael Apted. Okay. Yeah. Okay. That kind of thing in Boyhood, we've talked about before, I think is just absolutely fascinating to see how a singular person, or in this case, a group of people, change, especially from almost infancy or childhood, all the way up into adolescence to adulthood. And even 5 years is going to be, well, so the youngest one went from 5 to 10, Jeremy, is that how this goes?
Yes.
Okay. And the oldest went from 15 to 20. So that's, I mean, think about our childhoods or our adolescence from 15 to 20,
how much you changed. Yeah.
And then you throw in, trying to tell the world that your identity has changed. Even though you felt this your entire life, that's gotta be just, kind of mind altering. And I'm going to check this out.
Yeah. And again, you know, I should say I may have misgendered in talking about some of them. Like, I don't know if what their preferred pronouns were. I may have said she when they preferred they. Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, Elliot Page came out as trans yesterday as we record this, actor from Juno. And we've had, you know, conversations internally about, well, how is the best way to talk about this with, you know, while being sensitive, you know, and I think we're just in an age where there's going to have to be some grace for people who have 40 years ingrained speech patterns and muscle memory in their brain for certain ways to just, you know, we're so used to just assigning gender to people as soon as we see them. And that's changing, and that's going to change, and we want to change with it. So anyone that is familiar with this documentary or is trans or sensitive to pronouns, if I did misgender anybody or speak flippantly there, I do apologize. It's something that I want to be good at and get better at. So
I got along with the Patton Oswalt thing where he had a bit, I don't know how many years ago he did this, but you know, he's like, who's the asshole in this situation? So like the first person was like trying to say the right thing and trying, but he wasn't getting the right, you know, the right words and right verbiage out and everything. He was just, you know, like, you know, I don't know. I think it's okay. I just, you know, blah, 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 saying that kind of thing. And then the other person knew all the terms, but was saying it, saying a bunch of stuff that was just like, absolutely just crushingly wrong at the same time while he's saying the proper terms. And he's like, which one's the asshole in this situation, right? Like the person who's saying this stuff but not being very sensitive about it, you know, to me. So yeah, I think for a lot of us it's going to be a learning experience. You have to kind of figure out, you know, what people prefer, and you and I think we're, you know, that's sort of the bind we're in, I think, a lot of times. So I think from what I could hear, you seemed to say everything right there, but yeah, you're right. They could have preferred a different pronoun there.
I do like, and Jeremy, I'll cut this if you want me to, cause it's internal. But when we were discussing this, you mentioned that, you know, our kids or our kids' kids would eventually accept this as just, you know, a normal nomenclature where the speech patterns of they, them, he, she, that kind of thing will become normalized for trans people. And I think that's very, very important. And I'm glad you said that, because something like, you know, to take it back to pop culture, Euphoria, which is very, very casual about Hunter, I forget her last
Schaefer.
Name. Hunter Schaefer. Who's a trans woman or girl at this point. And it's not a big deal. It's not a big fucking deal. She does things sexually that are probably not good for her, but then she also has this relationship with Zenyatta.
Zendaya.
Zendaya. Jesus fuck. Like a brain fart there. Zendaya's character where... you know, it's completely normalized. They have a budding romance, just like you would see in, you know, a John Hughes movie from the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And once that does get normalized, I think that's very, very cool. But yes, for us and for our generation, it's a transition, not to be glib about the word. Sure. And I like working on that. I like thinking about that, saying, you know, let's all try to do this correctly or as correctly as we can get.
Yeah. There are, it's just new habits can be learned at any age. And my hope is that the children of this generation are, their habits that they're forming as kids are already including trans preferred pronouns and veering away from, you know, a gender skewed perspective of the world.
Mm.
All right. I am also in on the documentary front here. I haven't seen the entire series yet because they haven't shown all the episodes yet, but there's one on Showtime called The Reagans. Going on right now. Growing up in a 1980s conservative household, Ronald Reagan was the shit, man.
Yeah, he was. You had an Alex P. Keaton type of fascination with it. Yeah, man.
Absolutely. Ronald Reagan, every time he was on TV, you're like, man, that is a fucking president right there. And you never saw anything bad about Ronald Reagan. Nothing. And I even like today, if I see somebody saying something about Reagan, I'm like, but I remember him being so good and cool. You know, there was a Saturday Night Live rerun I saw, and it was Roseanne Arquette was the host on this Saturday Night Live, and she's like on her monologue, she's like, I don't know if you guys know or not, but there is a president right now who is just ruining the country. And I was like, how was he ruining the country in the 80s? I don't get it. Don't make any sense. So watching this documentary now, I'm older and wiser now. I mean, I know that I don't know to the extent how much he fucked up a lot of shit. But this documentary is clearly explaining everything. And it, the first episode talks about his rise through, Hollywood actor. And he was, I believe, the president of the union at the time of actors back in the day. And he even was called in that in the McCarthy hearings and everything, and he very artfully somehow dodged the question, which is something that Reagan is going to be very popular, like very good with when he becomes president, but artfully dodged it to where he's like I don't know of anybody who's doing any so like communist activities around here, not that I know of, you know, that type of thing. Basically saying there might be, but I didn't see it, that type of thing. But the first episode is through his humble beginnings and all that. And like his first marriage to Jane Wyman and then on to Nancy. And then it sort of ends, I believe, on his California governor run and everything. And then the second episode starts getting into his actual run in the 1980 presidential election and everything. But there were some things that just popped up in there that that really made me go, wow, I did not realize all of this had been going on at the time. And he's there's tapes of him with Nixon saying the N word. Well, I don't know if he says the N word. He says some very racist things to Nixon on this one thing. And it's just, it's like, oh, my God, I can't believe that came out of Ronald Reagan's mouth. A lot of people are like, well, yeah, of course it did, because they knew all along, but not me. Mm. And it was, and he went from this person who was like, a president of a union to becoming president of the United States, where he was breaking down unions and he was doing this trickle down economics thing where, like, there's this idea that if we give rich people more money, they'll redistribute the wealth all over the place, because that's what they do, right? They spend a lot of a lot of money on people. And people will get the money eventually by, they'll hire more people, and they'll, that there's this idea that if you get, if you give them tax breaks and everything, everything's going to be good. Everything's going to be perfect that way. And of course it's been long, long, refuted that trickle down economics doesn't work. But anyway, if you want to get a more complete character of Reagan and everything, I think this is a fascinating thing that they're doing. I don't know how many episodes there's going to be of the series. I just heard about it and decided to start watching it. Four total. So then it's 75% of the way through. That's disappointing, actually. I thought there would be somewhere around 8 or 9 on this, because
my Google said 4, but I could have misgoogled.
I tell you what,
you didn't misgoogle
on this, because like you, conservative household, Reagan was a god, essentially. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I've heard enough over the years that there was not only policy issues, but also that the man himself was not who he purported to be. There is speaking of Saturday Night Live, there's a great skit with, I believe, Phil Hartman is playing Reagan.
That makes sense.
He is the bumbling, like, just, hey, you know, talking to the kids that come into the Oval Office. How are you doing? You know, wait, do you want a lollipop? Okay, get out of there. And then all of a sudden, like, the secret wall opens and he brings out like this risk board and he's like, all right, kids, here's what we're going to do. We're going to nuke the Ukraine, and then we're going to move in over here. We're going to do this. And then like another kid comes in. He's like, oh, hey, how you doing? Right. Go see Nancy. And then he goes back and he's like this brilliant strategist. But yeah, he is. I think because it was a time that before the internet, obviously, and before people were so hypercritical and so polarized that people lionized him. If there were another Mount Rushmore, I feel like Reagan would be on there without much controversy. Mm-hmm. I think people would say, yeah, he was good enough for the entire country. You know, he got 2 terms, yeah, that kind of thing.
Mount Rushmore would never happen today.
I agree.
We would never be able to agree on anyone.
I agree. But I think he would be a shoo-in from the recent presidents. One of the only shoo-ins.
He was just a great orator.
The great communicator was his thing, right?
We've always had presidents here and there that were great speakers. JFK was a great speaker. Reagan was a great speaker. Bill Clinton was an amazing speaker.
Obama, yeah.
Barack Obama's a great speaker. But
Donald
that
Trump
covers up a multitude of sins, man. When you can be that good of a public speaker, you can win people's hearts, man. And that's what got him through, was not necessarily his policies. But I think if you pulled Twitter today about Reagan, with Twitter specifically, it would be like, God, there would be a lot of vitriol. A lot of people that just call him and George Bush war criminals casually, like they know more than I do. And I realize we went to war. And wow, I'm veering off the rails. I realize we went to war in the Middle East on flimsy evidence after 9/11. But I don't know. Do we just call former presidents war criminals then? Because every single one of them bombed somebody, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
It's that line in The Godfather where Kay is like, you know, senators and presidents don't have people killed. And Michael's like, ah. Now, who's being naive, Kay?
Yeah. Now, that's one thing that they show is like some of the absolute ridiculous things that they did, where they would have one of the things in the third episode that was just like, God, I didn't realize this was happening. Was they, you know, there was a one thing where Reagan basically sent out the message that all these the air traffic controllers, the strike that was an air traffic controller strike or whatever or something like that going on, and he said something like, if you guys don't return to work, you guys are just going to be fired and that's it. And they ended up all getting fired because you know, he, and it showed that he had this strength or whatever. And they even got his old Secretary of State Jim Baker, who I didn't know was still
Wow.
And he's like, he just fired those guys. Man, that was great, is what he says.
Wow.
And he, like, Jim Baker is still in love with Ronald Reagan. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But like there was a point where his message about like homelessness was that people wanted to be homeless and that they didn't want to do things. They were all lazy and all this type of thing. And so homelessness skyrocketed and everything. And then there would be stuff like where there was the economy was bad, and they decided to give everybody a tax break, but they were the government was about to run out of money basically. Yeah. But then Nancy Reagan goes in and like refurbishes the White House and the second and third floors. After all this other stuff, like the whole thing with people are hurting and everything, they show like a dinner that they had for Mubarak where there's like she ordered all this new China and everything for that dinner.
That shit.
Right. There's a lot of this type of stuff going on where you're like, oh yeah, I mean, it was pretty obvious now that you think about it, you know, but at the time you're like, oh, isn't that nice? Like, I mean, of course I wasn't really old enough to know like who Reagan really was.
Going over policy.
No. Anytime you just saw him, you're like, that's a great president. We're living in a great. If you watch the movies back in the 80s, man, like there were so many things about how people are so wealthy and so, you know, everything, their lives are so great and everything. Like that's what a lot of these 80s movies were about. It seemed like, you know,
everybody's
like,
doing cocaine.
Yeah. What a great time we live in. So anyway. The Reagans is a good thing going on, and I guess it's only got 4 episodes, so one more to go for me.
I'm gonna watch that shit. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you what, I did finish a series, and this is a redux. It's a reprise. It's a retread. I mentioned HBO's The Undoing episodes ago.
Mm-hmm.
That shit just finished up. It just finished up as we record this last Sunday. So I mentioned that I called it a wreck of what before because I didn't know what direction it was going at that point. Excuse me. At that point, I think it was the third, fourth episode or so. And I was like, ooh, this is intriguing. Rich people getting charged with murder, and then the wife, and then the kid, and then the Donald Sutherland. And then the Lily Rob, and then now we're starting into the legal stuff. And saw the last episode, and this series pissed me off so fucking much.
I want to
urinate on this series,
right?
But it's not a full warn, because everything leading up to that was pretty and well shot, and Nicole Kidman has coats, and as she's beautiful, and Donald Sutherland gives a great performance. Hugh Grant gives a great performance. The kid, who's British, everybody's weird accents everywhere. Everybody's British, but playing American, or Australian playing American and trying to do American accents. Suddenly they forgot how to do an American accent, except for Hugh Grant, who's still British as fuck. But this last episode wrapped up the mystery in a way. That I did not appreciate. What it proved to me at the end of this is that this series had no idea what it wanted to be. It at times it was a legal courtroom drama. At times it was a whodunit. At times it was a fantasy type of thing. At times it was an investigation. At times it was a love story. And a power struggle. And rich versus poor and stuff like that. And none of that shit got resolved. None of it got resolved. And I've never seen something so unsatisfying, maybe since Lost, the finale of Lost. Was I so unsatisfied with the ending of a series that almost invalidated the entirety of the previous episodes. I'm never going to watch this again. This is not going to be a Watchmen thing. Or anything where I go back to it and say like, oh, I want to dig into that. No, there's nothing to be said here. And what really pisses me off is that you read articles about this and Hugh Grant's like, yeah, that was my jam. I nailed that shit. I totally played that character exactly how I wanted to play. And Nicole Kidman's on there saying like, yeah, this series really dives into the psyche of the human mind. And this thing, and like it really explores these themes and stuff like that. And fuck that, man. No, it didn't. David E. Kelly's out there saying like, oh, this is important stuff. It didn't. No, it said nothing. It said nothing, and it pissed me off. And if you've started watching it, just abandon ship. Jump off the ship and run to the hills because it's it stinks. It's pretty to look at, but it stinks.
It's what are you going to expect, though, from the actors who make a show like this, right? I mean, they're never going to say that they didn't nail it or they didn't, you know.
Well, that was
I mean,
a real piece of shit.
Yeah, I mean, they will, but it'll be like 15 years later or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Looking at the IMDb scores for all the episodes, it is the last one is the lowest rated one of that bunch. So I think a lot of people are probably feeling the same way you are. You know what it reminds me of? It's another HBO series, The Night Of, that for me. Where it had this intriguing mystery and everything. And then, like, as it got further into the series, I was like, this is fucking ridiculous.
It became about vagina drugs.
It did become about what? Vagina drugs.
Mm-hmm. It really did. Yeah, we're not joking.
Oh, no, I never no saw joke it. There.
Vagina drugs. You put them up there?
Yeah.
Oh. You put them up there.
Mm-hmm. So it's been canceled, if that's any consolation to you. They were originally planning to make this like a recurring series. They've canceled it. The Undoing.
I don't even know how you do that. I mean,
the finale was the highest watched HBO show since the finale of Big Little Lies, which was huge. So people were all over this shit.
Yeah. Well, you ever gotten a hand job or a blowjob or had sex and you're like, man, I'm really about to like spray like a fire hose all over this place. And then like it goes bink, bink, like a couple of drops. That's what this show is.
That's never happened to me.
Yeah. You must have started thinking about baseball or some shit around the time that you were about to
like,
explode.
Oh, it's going to happen.
Bink. And then you're like, oh, Mark McGwire. I've been told Mark that, McGwire.
Of all the people to pick,
it really makes me limp.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you've ever seen him with a shirt off,
yeah. No
anyway, I've been told that you know, when we do these things, a lot of times people want to know, sort of get a reminder of what we went over, recommended, and warned, and everything. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to probably start doing that a little bit more. So Jeremy, he did Happiest Season. He reca-warned that. And you also reca-warned the HBO documentary series Transhood.
Mm-hmm.
On that, I recommended Ted Lasso on Apple TV and recommended The Reagans, which is on Showtime. And Barrett, you did reca-warn of Office Christmas Party. And you're still reca-warning The Undoing on
barely.
HBO.
It's more warn a wreck.
Warn erection.
Oh, there it went.
So I figured I'd just go back over those. We'll do that more often.
I like that.
We'll do that more often. So, this is gonna be the end of the episode, I think.
Yeah, I think so. We got a decent amount of chunks.
We did enough filler to get that 2 hours. It's pretty awesome.
Nice.
All right. That's going to do it for this week. Keep going to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins on Facebook. We're also on CinemaSins Twitter, Music Video Sins Twitter. We're also on SoundCloud and on Discord. If you want to get on Discord, you can go to the Reddit page and find a link on the right side, or you can private message me on Facebook and I will give you a link to Discord there. That's going to do it for this episode. It's Chris Atkins and Jeremy Scott and Barrett Scherer. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
Can you stay up all night? Fuck me to the daylight. 35. You know what? You know what? That new Ariana Grande song makes me. is exhausted.
Yeah.
I have no, as much as I love Ariana, I ain't got it. I ain't got it anymore to stay up all night and fuck her to the daylight.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm up all night to have fun. yeah, dude. I mean, as nice as it might be to have a really hot 20-something, early 30-something girlfriend who wants to have sex all the time, I couldn't do it. I couldn't keep
no.
up.
No.
My girl wants to party all the time, party all the time, party all the time.
Yeah, it's the Eddie Murphy greatness.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know what happens in this? Have you guys seen this video or listened to the song?
I have not.
The 34, 35?
Nope.
Yes, only to confirm that you were right about it being all about fucking.
Yeah.
I have.
Well, yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny because, you know, she's like, fuck me to the daylight. It's not like any subtlety whatsoever. But at the end of the song... At the end of the song, because 34 plus 35 is 69. And at the end of the song, I swear to God, she goes, means I want a 69 with you. And I'm like,
what?
Yeah. It means she wants to 69 with you.
Okay.
And it's all like, right. She that's a line. Like at the end of the song, it's like, means I want a 69 with you. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, we got that. You know what it reminded me of is in the Butthole song. And it's in the Sins video, actually. When Rose Byrne is doing her thing at Get Him to the Greek, where she's like, ring around the roses, a pocket full of she wants to have butt sex. Mm. And like, and at the end of it, she's like, and by posy, I'm talking about my asshole. And it's just that obvious. She's like, I want a 69 with you.
How did Ariana get hornier than 5 years ago, Haley Steinfeld?
Well, I don't know.
Haley Steinfeld just wanted to fuck herself, man. Mm-hmm. And I don't blame her. I would want to fuck me.
Yeah.
But that's still pretty horny.
I don't know. Hasn't Ariana Grande always been pretty horny?
I think so. Listen, I want to talk about something real quick. Have you seen this commercial for Match.com that Ryan Reynolds wrote that Taylor Swift's new recording of Love Story?
I haven't.
Okay. First of all, that was hilarious. but I want to talk about this Taylor Swift thing. Barrett.
Yes.
Has anyone ever done this? Re-recorded their entire first like catalog? Is this unprecedented?
Yes. As far as I can tell, I mean, there may be some indie artist or something like that that did it. But as far as to this extent, their entire catalog, I've never even heard of this.
Okay. So here's my prediction. Here's my prediction. She's going to give it away to her fans. At most, I think... if you bought the previous albums, you get these for free. I don't think she's going to charge much or anything for them. Because I think she wants to prove it was never about the money.
You got a point because, I mean, it's like Walter White, right? Like, when is enough? Does she have enough money? But she would make a fucking mint off of the re-release of this.
And I guess if she wants to now, dude has already Scooter has already resold these.
Yeah, records. Yeah. She's not, and those people wanted to work with her, but yeah. Scooter said that no, that was a contingency in the contract.
Yeah. And so she's not anything asshole. She does is not going to screw Scooter any further. She can't stick it to Scooter by making $200 billion by
besides
selling.
Devaluing the originals, though.
Right, but does she want to do that so bad anymore now that he doesn't have them?
He's still making money off of it, though. That was the contingency in that contract when he sold him, that he would still get a percentage of that. That's why she refused to work with that new company.
Maybe my prediction is too strong. She's going to do something unprecedentedly cool in the release of this music.
I would love that. And if you listen to that Love Story song in that Devil ad for Match, it sounds different. And it sounds, to me, better.
It sounds the same but different. And... she's not going to have that little girl voice anymore.
Yeah. I could dig on her current voice doing those exact same songs.
Yeah.
And she's even said this. She's like, I've grown as a singer, obviously. I was 15 years old when I recorded Fearless or Red or whatever the fuck it was. Or Speak Now, I guess, is her first one. I dig her voice now. I dig her mentality now. And I bet she could bring a little extra funk. A little extra stank to those old ones.
She's going to give away one, maybe two of these albums for free.
I mean, I could dig it. You're probably not wrong. She's the type of artist that would do that, I think.
Yes. Yes. Unlike Kanye.
Even if it's only to be magnanimous, you know, to be viewed as magnanimous, which I think there's a little bit of in her work. There's a lot of good stuff, but then there's a little bit of artifice, but you have to be Taylor Swift.
I mean,
right?
Once you get to that size of a star, you could say that about anyone. Like, oh, George Clooney gave 14 of his friends $1 million. That was a big story like a week and a half ago, right? I'm like, big fucking whoop. He's got billions. He just sold a tequila company for $50 billion. Like,
are you serious?
Yes.
Jesus.
All the actors are getting into alcohol and then selling them off. But they're following Kenny Chesney, who's following Francis Ford Coppola. Coppola.
What is Chesney's thing? What is Chesney's thing?
Wasn't Kenny Chesney the one that does the Blue Cher Bay rum? Because he was working with...
He is.
Yeah. So he owns that rum, went out on tour, and that was the only rum in the bar on tour. And by the end of his tour, which was for 5 to 10 years, the number one attended and selling tour in America, that rum was known across the whole country, and it now makes him more money than his best-selling tour.
Oh, that's I had no idea about that.
Yeah, Ryan Reynolds bought Aviation Gin.
Ryan Reynolds, yeah.
Put his face on it for a year, and then turned around and sold his stake for like 3 times as much as he put in.
Did he sell it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And I'm sure that tequila they were selling on Entourage ended up being a big thing too. Because they had a whole bunch of actors behind that, you know, when they would ever advertise it. I think Aaron Paul was on the ad, Danaya Ramirez. Mm-hmm. A lot of these people were on there on those ads. What was that called? That tequila on Entourage?
I don't remember.
Oh, Clooney's?
No, the one on Entourage.
Oh, Avion
is what it is.
Avion.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, yeah. Good memory.
The thing with Taylor Swift is that situation she was in was common. Like, nobody has ever thought that was a bad thing before, that somebody else would own the music that she made or anything like that. That's always been,
right.
That's something that's always been, it's always happened, but she's the one who first made a big, huge stink about it and then decided, all right, I'm going to record them all again.
In part, I mean, in no small part because of who it was that had bought them. Because
yeah, I think that's a big Peter deal.
Braun had specifically joined Justin Bieber in mocking Taylor a couple of times publicly. I think it was personal.
No, it had to be. I mean, that was the reason that she refused to work with this new company, is that she said, I can't fathom, even though I like you guys, because they reached out to her first. She was like, I like you guys, but if this dude is getting any part of my music, can't do it. And so, yeah, she hates us, didn't he? Seems like a butthole. A butthole.
I mean,
I don't know him personally, but probably a butthole.
If I had to pick which between him and Taylor, who's the butthole? That's a pretty easy pick.
I tell you what sucks though is and God bless her, she's gorgeous and I love her, but I don't know what's happening with her hair these days. Have you seen the hair with like the permy bangs?
Taylor Swift?
Yeah,
permy bangs.
Permy bangs.
I haven't seen it.
It's a weird look. It's a weird look
seen
for
it.
Permy
bangs.
No,
I'm
idea.
Not a big bangs fan.
I'm not a big perm fan.
My mom used to go get a perm. This is like in the 80s. I don't know if this was the look, but she would just come home and look like she stuck her finger in a light socket.
Yeah. Mine did too.
It's like, why do you want this? Why is this something that you want?
As with all things, it's not like it's going to be permanent or anything.
Hey-o.
Oh, nice.
Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Hey, he's a good boy. You remember that X-Files episode with the backwoods rednecks?
Was that the one that they didn't play? They had to ban or whatever?
I think so, yeah, right? Because I saw it live, man. And that episode was fucked up, man. Mm. It was the two brothers that were like all fucked up from the incest, and then they kept the mom under the bed, but she was like all, she didn't have arms or legs or anything. Mm-hmm. And when Mulder pulled her out, she was like, I haven't seen anyone since the War of the Northern Aggression. And she kept saying, like, they're such good boys. And it freaked me the fuck out, man. It was awesome.
Yeah, I didn't see it live. I mean, X-Files was weird. I don't think I watched it religiously. But there was a
point, did you not?
No, there was a period of time where I started watching it because it was a part of that Sunday block with Simpsons and everything. Yeah. There was a period of time that I did, but I think it was after that episode aired, like in the earlier part, in the earlier part of the 90s. Cause that was what, I don't know, season two, season three, somewhere around there.
Somewhere. Yeah. Season three, probably.
But I didn't even know about it until they, came out with, I don't know what happened with X-Files, but they said, Rita, and they're going to be able to play that redneck one that they haven't been able to play forever because of, I don't know if it got banned because it was insensitive or if it was because it was so sick or what. I don't know
what would have
to look that one up.
Caught that. Were you a big X-Files? You were a big X-Files guy, Jeremy, right?
For a time.
Yeah.
I didn't start in the beginning. I think I started around season two or three and I didn't watch all the way to the end. But
I didn't watch the last two seasons after Duchovny left.
I was pretty into it. Well, I stopped watching before Duchovny stopped participating. but yeah, it was kind of. I feel like if Lost had gone on for 9 or 10 seasons, I would have given up on that shit too. But while I watched it, I was really fucking into it. But I only ever. Unlike Lost, I have never seen X-Files episodes. I've never gone back through the series. I only saw them as I watched the show. Same as like 24. I've never seen those episodes twice.
Yeah, 24 is a weird one where I think I would probably enjoy going back and watching that. But when you kind of figure out the beats to everything, like it's going to be a torture scene. He's going to say, "Where? Let me see your hands." Not enough time. Damn it.
The
son of a bitch.
It came in season 4, episode 2. Episode is called Home. And it says Home originally aired on the Fox network on October 11th, 1996. It had a Nielsen rating of 11.9 with a 21 share, meaning that roughly 11.9% of television equipped households and 21% of households watched television were tuned into the episode. It was watched by approximately 18.85 million viewers, which, by the way, I think that would be like number one these days. Cause like,
Cause
Big Bang Theory was number one for a long time and it was getting like 9 or 10 million or something like that. Home was the first X-Files episode to have a viewer discretion warning for graphic content and the only one to have carried a TVMA rating upon broadcast, with the opening scene being cited in particular due to its gruesomeness and its similarity to stock horror film conventions. The only other instance of an episode of the X-Files earning a viewer discretion warning was in season 8 episode Via Negativa. Owing to that content, the network would not repeat the episode, the only time in the history of the series that this happened. In 1997, when the channel FX ran an all-day marathon of the most popular X-Files episodes, Home was the number one choice.
Nice. It's so good. No, that first scene, I believe, involves her delivering a baby.
Oh,
and they may have killed the baby. I don't. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but man, that was so disturbing. But I'm
setting an excellent tone for the day.
No. I mean, it really. I adored the X-Files. I was obsessed before probably season 8 or so when Mulder left. But I absolutely was obsessed with this show, whether it was a Monster of the Week or whether it was the mythology stuff. And I'm like you. I haven't gone back and watched all of them. I've watched a few of them. The movies are trash. The first one's all right. I kind of enjoy going back. It's very dated, especially like the clothing and the cars and like the environment. But I could probably go back and get obsessed all over again.
Do we have shows like that anymore, really? That's a really a naive question, but I don't watch much like TV.
People tried to copy it right afterwards, just like Lost.
Well, I think a lot of Supernatural fans would say that show, but I've never seen it, and I don't know that it's the same. But I think that captured a lot of the same audience.
Yeah, there was something about X-Files that tapped into something different. Like it was, there's something, because there was something bigger, right? The truth is out there. And everything. Supernatural is more about like, well, we already know this shit exists, so you know.
Yeah, that's true. Or there's not the mystery of it.
We don't know it exists, but this is happening behind the scenes and it's all supernatural and everything. I've seen like a couple episodes of Supernatural. I'm sure Jonathan has seen all the entire series, but
yeah, I haven't seen it.
But
I'll tell you one thing that tried to copy X-Files was Millennium.
Yeah.
It actually aired right after X-Files.
Lance Henriksen.
One season.
Yeah,
and it was fucking awesome.
Yeah,
it was awesome.
But
got the X.
Yeah, and they also had the three nerds that were in the basement that were always
the lone gunman.
The lone gunman. They tried that for a while too, but it doesn't seem like there's a big truth out there type show going on right now. Like something that's got that kind of. And you could watch
it. Queen's Gambit.
Well, Queen's Gambit. Besides that, though, Barrett. Besides that. and that was only seven episodes, anyway.
Yeah.
Fuller House.
Yeah. You know what? We're answering. I just answered my own question. I mean, there's plenty. There's plenty out there. What was the other X-Files meme that was, I want it. What is it? I want to believe. Was remember the kid who got trapped in the hot air balloon and it was a big hoax. Somebody did a meme. I think after I don't know if it was probably not after they found out it was a hoax. Where it said I want to be alive.
Oh, Jesus. That's sick.
God, I guess after I'm only they figured out that it was because hoax. He lived. If he had not lived,
oh, that would, I know,
that would be so fucking morbid.
No kidding.
I mean, he lived because he never went up in the balloon.
No. Right. Right. 6 minute ads.
No, not 7 minute abs. That's 6 minutes. I love his face before he says that. Harlan?
Harlan Williams.
Name? Harlan Williams, where he's like, until somebody comes out with 6 minute abs, and then he's like, he like glitches a little bit. He's like, glitches. No, seven
brides
for seven brothers.
Yeah. You know that old what is it? That old tale from the sea.
Would you like to know more?
Yeah.
What was I thinking about? There was a Paul Verhoeven. Oh, it was when I was thinking about movies we love to hate. Like, there's a lot of Paul Verhoeven that I could have put in there.
Yeah.
I put Showgirls, but like Basic Instinct could be in there. And to me, RoboCop could be in there. And,
when I last saw Showgirls, when we did that interview with the guy who did the You Don't Know Me documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed something about nudity back in the 90s. Like, all the women have the same kind of body. Back in the 90s, like, there's something about the hips and the ass that are just like they've sculpted it just a certain way. It's very strange. You don't see it anymore. You don't see that same kind of nudity anymore.
You could see a parallel between Sharon Stone and Elizabeth Berkley.
Sharon Stone has almost the same kind of body that Berkley does. And I saw some other movie that came out around that time. I was like, what is the deal? I was outside of my horniness, I was able to analyze it and go, there's something about what they were doing back then that was accentuating hips and like ass shape in a way that
even Eyes Wide Shut does that.
Yeah.
like all the women in the, I always, because that's not really my type, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, when Nick Nightingale's like, and the women, you know, the blindfold slipped and the women.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And I was like,
yeah. Yeah. Just saying, when you see nudity today, it's nothing like what you saw in the 90s. It's insane. It's, I don't know what it is. They were all going to the same trainer or something. I don't know.
We will work on your ass today.
Yeah. Yeah. We want to make your hips look like they cut glass, you know, that type of thing.
I don't know why the trainer is like Romanian.
Yeah. I don't either. They have to be, though. They have to be something.
We will work on the hips on the ass
they're
today.
They're not American. That's for sure.
You think he's got a hua down there?
Not well. Why would he have her show up like 2 hours before he?
Maybe it's like the office Christmas party where Dopinder gets the hua, and she gives hand jobs to all of his coworkers in the bathroom. I'm giving.
Oh, I love that.
Jillian Bell is great in that, where she's like, "I can't hear you over my gun who's pointed at you."
I love when the whore starts giving hand jobs to everybody in the bathroom.
She came up to me and she was like, hey, $40, I'll give you a hand job. He comes out and he's like, you can't give hand jobs to my coworkers.
Oh, my God. It's funny shit.
I like that movie a lot. Paul Dano's one of them. Gandalf Feeney, Chris Cooper, and some other guy. Mm-hmm. Oh, Forrest Whitaker.
I saw a weird ass Paul Dano movie the other day where he's a writer and the girl he writes in his book comes to life and becomes his girlfriend.
Oh.
And he can change her by writing about her.
Oh.
And so it's make like her fiction and weird science put together.
Yeah, it wasn't very good.
Oh, really? Yeah, that sounds like a really good premise.
Well, maybe you'll like it.
Maybe I'll try it.